Well, welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower, and tonight we are going to have a great show. We're dealing with a topic that I haven't really fully explained at any time since I've been doing this particular kind of teaching. And the interesting thing about this is that last week I mentioned some things about it, and I think that there might have been some interest piqued about it. This is a show about the energy kingdom. Now, most people don't think of energy as having really anything to do with life other than it uses energy, right? How could there be a kingdom of energy? Because kingdoms are kingdoms of life, right? And that's what we're going to talk about today, because in reality, the energy kingdom is a kingdom of life. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a kingdom, not in the true sense of the word. And pre-life, yes, energy theoretically is part of pre-life, too. You, those of you who know the difference, pre-life has less than three centers, or at least it has, pre-life cannot use three centers in order to produce life within itself. God's answer to diversity in life, or of life, or for life, is to create energy. And you might say, well, what's that about? I mean, you know, isn't energy just something that's out there? Well, if you really think that, you know, then you don't have a really good grasp on the whole process. But at the same time, it's also been inundated into our system of knowledge that energy is a thing. And it doesn't have any realm of consciousness. It doesn't exist within any element of growth or life, of life. It doesn't grow, per se. It's just like subatomic and atomic particles that do things, and waves, and that's about it. Yeah. Okay. So tonight we're going to be discussing both sides of the fence. I want to go into some of the concepts as they are presented today, so that we can look at those concepts and see how, when you broaden them and look at from another angle, those things aren't wrong, they're just vastly incomplete. And because of the incompleteness of most people's knowledge about this, they can make the assumptions that are made in most sciences that energy is some phenomenon of the way various atomic and subatomic particles behave together, including the waves those particles may manifest. Or be affected by, I should say. The whole concept here is one of minimalism compared to, we'll call it, completeness. When you minimalize anything that is life, you usually, almost always, destroy the real or full definition of life to the point where you may not be able to recognize what life is anymore. Even for things that we say are alive, we don't understand that that life may have consciousness that we are not aware of. So let me start off with a definition so that we understand. I've sort of talked around it, so we understand what I mean by the energy kingdom. Energy is the third part of God's mind, okay, in some manner of manifestation based upon dimensional issues. The more that energy joins with time, and the more time joins with space, the closer you come to reaching the original state that energy comes from, which I'll explain what that is, which is getting very close to the third part of God's mind. All right? I hope I didn't lose you yet, but if I did as I explained this, it'll make more sense than it does at this moment. And so, going back again, we're still trying to define energy. We haven't even got there, the kingdom issue. The part of energy that we identify with in this realm is the part where energy is most separated from time and space. Time provides a quality to space that allows energy to move through it much more freely until the quality becomes enlightened, and then the energy moves through it with no resistance at all. But the quality of space, unfortunately, in this realm, for most things, is far below the speed of light, and very little of space is actually enlightened. So we have, within the process, only a few sources of, we'll call it, light. Some, a few that have been created by humans and beyond, and the rest created by stars and that sort of stuff. But outside of those sources of light, the remaining space, which is vast, is tremendously separated from both time and energy's connection to it through time, because the energy is in two states at the same time. It's usually extremely, by our standards, cold, relatively, compared to a star, anyway. And at the same time, it is it's very resistant to movement. Now, the resistance to movement has a condition, and that condition we call gravity. But it also has another condition, which we call inertia. And between the gravity of energy, which I'll further define in a minute, and the inertia, the movement of energy in our realm is inordinately difficult. Inordinately. A practical example. In the physical world, you want to throw a ball that weighs a pound, and you try to throw it from here to, well, we got some listeners in Australia, from here to Australia. And you don't go very far. I mean, it goes a couple hundred meters or yards, and it doesn't do much of anything. That's if you've pretty got a good arm, you know? And you look at that and you say, holy moly, I can't throw more than a few hundred feet to maybe 150, 300, 500. It depends if you've got a really good arm. But it's not very far. And it's certainly not going to make it from here to Australia. But that's in this realm. That's because the time is so separated from the space, and the quality of both leads energy into a high level of inertia. Inertia is the lack of ability, okay, to overcome this equation of time and space. And it leads to what we think of as the inability for energy to move very effectively, mostly caused by gravity. So we're throwing a ball and there's a huge amount of gravity by Earth, but also caused by other resistances from other gravities besides Earth's, and by the resistance of substances such as air, etc., which causes frictional forces. And all of that leads to a state in which the initial at-rest inertia is very hard to overcome, and even when you give it a boost, it's quickly diminished by gravity and by friction. And because the two are at almost 90 degree vector forces, it's a whole other thing, one doesn't affect the other. So as an example, if you threw a ball straight where there's a 90 degree angle to the ground and you dropped a rock or a pebble at the same time, they would both land at the same time regardless of how fast you threw the ball. And you say, well, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. Well, it does. It actually does. That's disallowing for the frictional element of the air. So there is a slight difference, but most people, it's virtually immeasurable, especially when you use a dense, relatively dense object. Okay, so here, if you imagine if you used a paper wiffle ball, that would not be true, or, you know, a paper ball or a wiffle ball, because then the resistance of the air becomes greater per the mass of the object, and the resistance then does increase, and so they don't exactly fall at the same time. But it's a very interesting effect at any rate. Energy is fascinating from that standpoint, but when we get to the astral world, taking our example a little bit, we'll say a field. In the astral world, you could throw a ball from what you would, might call your side of the United States, although it may not be exactly like the U.S. in reality, but and you could throw it to what, again, would be the equivalent of Australia, and the results would be that the ball could actually go there. Why? Well, because time and space are so much closer together, and the phase relationship of energy to time and space is not as severely out of phase. So they're acting together more in unison, and there's a real big key to this. Energy follows thought greater than its own thought. Okay, energy thinks, yes, it does. But most of the thought of energy that we are used to is really kind of fairly stupid energy that mostly thinks about getting together with other energy and creating more of itself. And when it becomes matter or mass, it then develops considerable levels of gravity. So it's a fascinating thing. And then space curves around, it appears to curve around the energy, but it really curves around the separated time from the space. But that's a whole other thing that I'm not going to get into. But read chapter 10 of Life's Hidden Meaning if you really want to hear read about how that physics works. But at any rate, so here we have an interesting effect, because in the astral world, the thought of the person, which is just creative imagination, it's not even mental thinking, it's just creative imagination, if you think that that's not as big a deal, but it is in the astral world. As long as you can imagine the ball traveling to where you want it to go, if you throw it, and you don't have to have any great physical, quote-unquote, strength, because there's no physical anything there, as long as you throw it, or even if you don't throw it, if you just think it, the ball could travel all the way, you know, like 13,000 miles or whatever it is, to Australia. Yeah, and not only that, but if your senses are extremely enlightened, it could travel there at the speed of light in the astral world, which is way faster than the speed of light here. It could be as much as about, give or take, 24 times faster than here, in the physical world. That's a lot of speed. And further, if you could imagine the ball there already, if you have that ability, and you've been to the place that we're talking about, so now you can't just think about going to Australia. You have to have been there, done that, and you've got to have a good picture of the ball. You could recreate the ball at maybe 100 to 1,000 times faster than the actual speed of light. How do you do that? Because we think, according to Albert Einstein, that there is a speed limit on energy moving through normal time and space. And that's absolutely true. But since time can do two things, it can join in the present tense with space, but time is really three things. It's the past, the present, and the future. If you can join the future part of time with space, you can go hundreds of times faster, at least in the astral world, up to 1,000 times faster or more in the mental world. That's really amazing. That is so amazing that you almost have to say to yourself, holy cow. Now, let's say that you're an alien. I've been throwing a lot of science at you, and that may be unfair, but I like to do it in the beginning of the show, because by the end of the first hour, most people say, calm down, those huge concepts, I can't follow them. Okay, so that's why I do it the way I do it. But let's go off into a story. Let's say you're an alien, okay? You're an alien, and you live 150 light years from Earth in the Pleiades, all right? In part of the Pleiades. Now, some parts are actually more than that, away from us. The nearest part might be 150, 200 light years from Earth. Did I say million? I meant 200 light years. Or 150 light years. So you live that far away, which is very far, by the way. That's a huge, it's a 6.5 trillion miles in, you know, light year and stuff like that. It's a really long way. Okay, and and you want to travel to Earth, and you've got a very, very, very special kind of spaceship that's made out of the energies of the physical world, the astral world, and the metal world all joined together. You got one heck of a spaceship. Now, anybody that looked at it, if they could see anything, would only be able to see the physical unless their bodies were joined. So guess what? The folks that take that spaceship have to have their bodies all joined together so their senses work together, and that's called being a superhuman or a master. So we know anybody that's coming in that spaceship has to be someone really far along in consciousness. But let me tell you how it works. Because the spaceship is made out of those three-dimensional energies, and they're connected to three different types of time, through the consciousness of the beings using the ship, they can alter its expression. So they can take the ship into the top of the metal world, if you can imagine that, and come here at least 1,000 times faster or more. 1,000 times would still be only at the speed of light of the metal world. So they could come here many times faster than that. Thousands of times faster than the speed of light, they could get here in their super fast spaceship. And no, they're not going through a black hole, and they're not going through a wormhole. They're going through another, it's called interdimensional travel. And there are formulas, that some of which are actually in Life's Hidden Meaning, that you can do, particularly if you're familiar with Max Planck's constant, and you can actually figure all of this out mathematically. If you're a physicist and you're listening, give me a call. We can talk about it. But of course, I'm not going to go through those formulas. That would bore everybody to death. And I'm not sure I could right now. You got to kind of look at it and rework it. You don't remember that stuff. Who would want to, right? But at any rate, this is the means. This is the means for getting around a galaxy that's 180,000, whatever it is, light years from one side to the other. I mean, it's a long, long time. Yet, if you're going at 1,000 times the speed of light, that at least takes it down to 180 years or whatever. And I think it's for going diagonally from the bottom of one arm to the top of the other arm and going every possible long way around. And for a lot of times, it's probably a lot less than that. So it could be down to just, if you just do a straight line without going three-dimensionally, it might be less than, I think it's more than 100,000, but whatever. It's still a stable time, but obviously, depending upon where you're coming from. So you can do this amazing, amazing way of travel by just using the mental world, and some of these beings, if they have Atmic consciousness, could use the Buddhic world. The Buddhic world, speed of light is over 140,000 times greater than it is in this dimension of time and space, And, again, you could be multiples of that. So now you're talking about you could travel across the entire galaxy from the furthest sides of them, and you could do so in way less than a year, and you could do it in really, potentially, you could do it in maybe days or weeks. This is a pretty remarkable way of understanding the whole situation. Now, a lot of you are going to say, well, what about running into things? Well, you can't run into anything. Because once you get out of the physical dimension of time and space, there is no physical energy. And all the other kinds of energy move aside to let you through when you're coming. And then we get into the last order is what you don't even have to do what I just said, but it would be take enormous amounts of consciousness. But let's say you get a 50 or 100 of these folks together in one place, in a spaceship, we'll call it. And instead, you decide not to do any traveling, per se. You're just going to recreate. Now, you have to, one of those people has to already been to Earth, say, if they're coming to Earth, and know what they're going to, etc. But recreate yourself, either astrally or mentally, and you would get here within maybe minutes to hours. Probably closer to minutes, depending upon the consciousness. So it's like almost instantaneous across unfathomably great distances. Now, if you want to go to another galaxy, that is the only way. But then the problem is how you have to have been there to do it. So once you get one being at this level able to do it, they share that beingness with others, and before long, among all the great beings in the universe, they can do it, but we can't, right? Because unless they could give us their consciousness, we're not going to be able to achieve it. But I'm trying to explain how extra dimensions and going interdimensionally, amazing abilities to go from one place to another are achievable. The idea of going there by using energy from the physical realm or even the etheric or electromagnetic realm is insufficient to go any significant distance in terms of travel within our galaxy. And that includes warp drive. Even the warp drive effect is just too long to go very far. Years, if not lifetimes. And when you get back, you may not have aged, but everybody else has. Unless if you're truly warping, then time remains the same for you, but the problem is it's still going to take a long time to go somewhere. Even if you warp space dozens of times, which is very radical, the amount of energy you have to use is enormous. You would definitely have to use antimatter, but the problem is getting there would still be an inordinate period of time. I mean, to go across even half the galaxy would take decades of your time, which would be the same as people's Earth's time. I know people say, well, if you're going past the speed of light, you know, or going at the speed of light, doesn't the clock stop for you? Not when you warp space. When you warp space, the clocks remain the same. It's a little hard to explain. But it proves the concepts I'm saying tonight. Since they already know, physicists already know what I'm talking about, that when you warp space, it also explains how time separates, or you can rejoin time with space, and all kinds of things come in to play from that knowledge. Okay, I'm a little bit off the subject, but it's kind of interesting. It's fascinating stuff. All right, so a little bit of science, maybe fiction, but I'm saying it's not. I'm actually going out on a limb and saying there are huge numbers of beings throughout the entire universe, the physical universe, physical part of the universe, that travel in these ways. Now, they may not live most of the time in the physical part of the universe. They may live in the middle world. They may live in the astral world, on planets that either we can't perceive or they live in the dimensional parts of the planets that the physical part looks like there's no life there, but they live in the astral, mental, or even Buddhic dimensions, and that's where they hang out. But they can still come to the physical if they want. Just the way a master or someone that is like superhuman being, can do that today, right here. Right? They can exist in the etheric world. That's where they may live, and visit the physical, astral, mental, They may live at times in the astral world or the middle world because their bodies are unified. They have all the seven senses, major senses, that have consciousness in them, in the three bodies, become one, just a unified single sense of all that is. And they can travel through these dimensions once they have sense capable of doing so and consciousness matching sense. Fascinating, because the consciousness is part of the sense, and it has to match the sense in order to unify them. Okay. All right. Getting back to energy. I know, tonight's show is supposed to be about energy. What are you talking about all these other things? I'm throwing out all kinds of stuff. What the heck? You know, these shows, oh, by the way, these shows are going to go a little bit less time after, I think it's after tonight. I remember I have another week of it. I have to check. And I think I have another week. But we're going to have a show coming on after the show's over. We've still got our 2 hours, but the extra half hour that's generously been given to us by the station. And I mean given. They haven't actually charged for that, which is very, very nice. Because this is not, you know, it's a business. They got to make a living and everything else. You got to pay for all this. So it's been gratis. But now, after several months of time, we're going back to the way it was, which is 2 hours. So tonight I can kind of elaborate a little bit more and still get everything in that I would have done under any other circumstances. All right. So why is it God's... Well, first of all, I have to define kingdom. I'm sorry, I didn't do that. A kingdom is a limitation on life or pre-life so that one part of life that has lower consciousness than another part of life, on average, does not significantly impede the development of the higher life. That's the reason the kingdoms exist. And you say, well, how do you prevent this from happening? Well, it's strange, but it actually has something to do with energy. The energy of the kingdoms become limited by the consciousness that the life develops within its senses. And so energy that is the same energy in a more conscious being has more capabilities and produces less forces. The forces, therefore, imposed on the life prevent it from being able to impair higher, more conscious levels of life. And they're collected together in a kingdom because they interact more with each other because they can't do much interaction with those higher in consciousness. First of all, their senses don't work very well, if at all, to sense the higher consciousness of life. And in addition, there are just physical forces that are too great and use up all of their energy in the process of trying to do so. And they're just weak. Now, the process could be as simple as a single ant, trying to significantly bother a human being. Now, they could do that. One can bite you and you don't like it and you slap it and it's dead. But that's one of the forces that it could entail. Now, if you get a whole army of ants, they could be fatal. Because collectively, the consciousness of the army of ants, believe it or not, is additive to some degree. Consciousness usually is not additive, but it is if they're only using it for the purpose, in this particular case, of either defense or offense, they can actually, if as long as it's limited enough to equal their sense collectively together, they can actually use that if that's part of their gene structure that they can collectivize their senses. Certain ants can do that. Certainly fire ants can. But humans are individualized, and they can't. Only superhumans can, again. So we are limited from that standpoint ourselves, and we can't affect the superhuman kingdom very much, nor can we affect the higher realm, which we're going to be talking about, of the energy kingdom. It's going to be fascinating to hear about this, because the energy kingdom is so much different than anything that you've probably ever thought about or heard about. It's a unique kingdom of life. Unique. Okay. So the fascinating thing about this, and again, I know this is probably more information than you can grasp. But you can re-listen to the show again. So remember that. Not tonight, but in a few days. So here is the kind of the bottom line. These kingdoms keep order and allow there to be ordered synthesis without chaos to some extent. And the greatest chaos doesn't come from the lower kingdoms affecting the higher, but from the higher affecting the lower, which is almost always, guess what, humans messing up one of the two lower kingdoms of life, and certainly the kingdom of pre-life, which is what we think of as chemicals, minerals, that kind of stuff. So we are definitely messing around with those things, and we do have an effect on them because the system goes in one direction only. That's it. And once our senses are greater than the collective senses of whatever we're dealing with, and we've far surpassed that in terms of the pre-life kingdom, so minerals and chemicals and, you know, elements and all that stuff, we have far more control over them than they even come close to controlling us. But if you deal with plants, there again, we've in the last few hundred years, we've gained great superiority over all plants. Not too many plants are going to be bothering us, that's for sure. But, of course, they wouldn't anyway. Not unless they have a collective ability or a collective defense, you could call it. But in any case, plants, generally speaking, are de minimis in their abilities to do much, unless we eat them. And they are toxic kinds of plants. There aren't a lot of those, but there's enough to be concerned. And they are toxic not just to us, but to probably most of the animal forms. Now, what does that say? The plants, as a defense, can protect themselves. But as an offense, you're not going to go to battle with the plants. They're not going to give up and attack you. They don't. That's what I meant when I said that. So, yeah, if you go and try to eat a plant, say, well, I'm going to make you sick. Or if you are starting to touch it and do things that it doesn't want to be done, it may give you an itch. Poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac. Those kinds of responses are defensive. But the plant is not going to dig up its roots and start attacking you. Now, I know in science fiction you see that. And it could be true that plants do have eventually the ability to actually have animation or movement. Without calling them animals, they still have plant-like qualities. But that seems to only happen on worlds that are sacred, where the plants now have started, in the sacred world, the kingdom system breaks down. You don't need the protection as much. And so plants start becoming somewhat animal-like, and minerals may take on even a plant-like existence. But that's a world that we aren't in. We're not in a sacred world. We're not in a world where people are enlightened and everything around them is enlightened. We're in a world where most things are dark and the people are dark, too. Yep, that's pretty much it. So can we get to the sacred state? Yeah. And again, in Life's Hidden Meaning, this is explained with pictures and stuff, so you can look in there if you've got that book. But the fascinating thing about this is when you deal with the question of how kingdoms work, they are temporary, but very, very important, and without them, there could be havoc and chaos in a universe that hasn't become enlightened. So it's necessary to have it until most of the universe is enlightened. Okay, so God's answer to the diversity of life is to have the third part of its mind be able to create huge amounts of forms and of differing and varying kinds, and huge amounts of differences in energy that we don't even barely know about, which I'm going to explain tonight. But that provides life with an amazing amount of diversity. Most of God's plan goes through beings called monads. The monad, it means the one. The monad contains all three parts, effectively, of God's mind. So there's three kinds of monads, first, second, and third. They call them ray types. And they can split into spirit and energy And when they first do this, it becomes part of the spiritual plane, or we can call it spirit with energy. And the reason it's spirit is because the first two parts of God's mind, when together and somewhat balanced, become spirit. And not only is the spirit on the atmic plane or spiritual plane, tremendously energetic in a sense, it is also enlightened. So the enlightened energy there is spirit that is enlightened. And even the energy itself is pretty well equal in enlightenment to the spirit. So you have enlightened spirit, enlightened energy. Pretty cool. And that's the highest part of any energy being, is to have that kind of energy within it. Most energy beings don't, okay? But the energy that starts off in the universe comes from the monads and the monadic planets, the second part, second dimension. First dimension is where God's found, basically, and in the highest part of it, you can say that's God's realm. God exists within our universe, within the bigger part of our universe. And so, but in the second dimension, the monads exist, and it's called the monadic plane. That's one of its names, or the plane of one. It's used, and there's other names. So those names refer to the beings that hang out there. And that's pretty much all that is. Now, they exist as non-energy beings. If all the energy comes from them, how could they exist as non-energy beings? Well, they do a little trick. They live on the inside of it's kind of the opposite of us. It's almost a reversal. They live on the inside of a sphere of energy. A huge, beyond our imagination and size, sphere of energy, and also it's super energetic. And within this sphere, they exist in a realm of pure consciousness. So what is pure consciousness? Well, it's the first two parts of God's mind, or what we would call spirit if it were separated. But it's not separated from energy in the lower dimensions. It's separated from energy in this monadic dimension. The monads choose to keep it that way. They don't want to have form. They don't want to have energy. They want to create life in all the lower dimensions as a part of God, to assist God in this, by the way, and to add more diversity by each of them doing this. Some of them do it more on an individual basis, literally, for humans, and others do it for collectively all kinds of creatures. And for superhumans, they are part of their monad, so they're really individual. In other words, your individuality, based upon what I just described about monads, increases as you advance in consciousness. Increases. Just by that explanation, you can see that that would be true. All right. We've got about a minute left here before I'm going to go to commercial. So what I'm going to do is just explain that this system is how the beginning of diversity works. Without it, it would be very difficult to make a diverse system because of various contradictions and paradoxes. So, ultimately, the system is really amazing because it allows there to be huge amounts of diversity, but at the same time, a reduction of the chaotic elements. And that includes the use of kingdoms, but it's more involved than that because you also have these super conscious beings deciding what parts of the energy that surrounds them, but they're not living in, they're contained by it, but they're not living in it, that they're going to give with an equal amount of their spirit or some amount of their spirit so that the two can eventually become a life form. And we'll talk more about the rest of all that when we come back from break, which is going to be about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the energy kingdom, God's answer to the diversity of life. And the interesting part of tonight's show is that it is probably going to have more, we'll say, side roads and offshoots and other factors because diversity does that. If you're talking about, well, how does God make life diverse? Well, you have to talk about a lot of different examples of the diversity to get the whole concept. So we'll be doing that. Now, let me continue on with, I actually have some, I usually do have some people in the studio around me. And one of them said, well, couldn't the aliens choose to just come to Earth without a spaceship, basically? They could just come here on their own. Yeah, they can. They could do that. Except bringing themselves collectively together and having various sources of some form things that may be mental or astral form, but it still is a form thing, which can be converted by them to physical form, is very efficient. To try to create those things once they arrive, so to speak, and start interacting means that they have to go back to the mental world if they're dealing with anything in the physical world. And it is not as efficient. Also, there could be many reasons why being collectively together, including the ability to travel much more quickly with the collective consciousness, than otherwise. Now, it is true they could communicate with each other in any place, from anywhere. But there is a difference. There is a difference. Like, I'll give you an example. In the astral world, if two people are separated by thousands of miles, they can communicate with each other, but it isn't instantaneous. And even when it is, you miss some of the nuances of communication without having full presence. It's no different than here in the physical world in some respects. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be done. And I don't want you to think that, you know, super beings can't do things like that. They can, but generally they try to be collectively together if they can. Or they could try to join their consciousness being distant planets apart from each other. I imagine it would be less efficient, but it could be done fairly easily, but not maybe nearly as much so as to be around each other. Okay, so those are the answers to that idea. Now, let's move into the question of this diversity. In order for God to come up with a system where life could be diverse and free, it needed to allow a system of separation of life in which the system was not created through God's deterministic thought, which would control what is known as the future. So if God did that, the problem, if we go back to the whole concept of time and space, if God was deterministic, and the proof that God couldn't be deterministic is this, if God were to be deterministic, then the future of time would always be separated from space, and there couldn't be multi-dimensions. That collapses the whole idea of how the universe works. It breaks down some of the models using Planck's constant in the higher realms. And it refutes most of the observable, from my standpoint and a number of others, conditions that exist in other dimensional realms. So you have, from that, a virtual proof, if you want to call it that, in concept, if not mathematics, which could be done, that the deterministic principles of a science, say, or a theory, things like astrology usually have built into them determinism. Those things can't be right because the concept of freedom, which is the very first part of God's thought, gets either diminished or destroyed by removing the future from the ability of life to use it. And so that the whole, and that increases forces tremendously and would entrap all life in the dense physical world if it existed here. It would certainly entrap it wherever it was. And interdimensional travel would become likewise impossible, and life would become isolated, and diversity would kind of go by the wayside. Most of what we think of as diversity would become minimalized, and everybody would be kind of like little robots. And obviously that must be true because you'd all be following or resisting the foul, but one of the two, God's thought, and that's it, little marching orders. Well, you could see that none of that is really true. And although some people do that, and evil wants that to happen, because it's trying to destroy God. So since that God's answer to this whole thing is to have freedom and to not manipulate the future part of time, for that matter, doesn't manipulate any of the parts of time, truly, then time and space can be interwoven in terms of their amounts of, we'll say, joining, and those differences in joining starts to build kingdoms. It makes dimensional realms. It creates space and time of each dimension and subdimension. It does all the things that allows life to diversify and further to be kingdoms, because the kingdoms exist by certain limitations from the various dimensional energies and time. So they exist, and if you look in Chapter 9, the first few pages, I explain all that, but it's so fast. Most people go, huh? They don't really follow what I'm talking about. But now I'm explaining it better, and maybe people will follow what I'm talking about. So that's the reason. It's designed to do this. And it's not some kind of design that's so obtuse and oblique and whatever that you can't really get it. You can. We can get it. And humans can. But you have to really let go of a lot of prejudicial, egotistical thought that comes from the realm mostly of science. And so this present level of science is, give or take, about 95% inaccurate. Now, I know that sounds terrible. But the 5% is really better than it's been. Science has only been around in any strong sense, where everybody has some pretty good understanding of science, for just a few hundred years. Before that, only very few people had a really decent understanding of science, and those people were usually people who were spiritual, very strongly spiritual. Now, since more people can get it, most people can, because they've developed, the human race has developed in consciousness. That's something that most history books don't teach. The science that people have is a tremendous amount compared to what was even the most conscious people from hundreds of years ago. And so from that angle, people have a lot of egotistical viewpoints, usually based upon sociological needs and reasons, that causes them to see the universe in a very narrow way and to mistakenly sometimes believe in either determinism or chaos, one of the two, not able to see God. When you don't see God, you have a choice, chaos or determinism. That's it. If it's determinism, then you may see God, but the God you see isn't the God that is there, and it leads to darkness, because the dark side uses that to hurt one's understanding of God. And where if you go with the chaos side, then there's no God at all, then you're an atheist. And a lot of scientists are on the chaos side. So you know, they get into both of those realms, but more scientists are these days are on the chaos side. So you get into this part where the untruth comes from the beginnings of most of the different sciences, particularly the physical ones, but also the biological, too. You know, I talked last week about some of the issues dealing with questions of how life didn't just evolve. Evolution is a mechanism used for some forms of life, very least amount used in human development, but still, it's real. It's real from that standpoint, particularly if you're Charles Darwin and you go to some islands where creatures have been isolated a long time, but there aren't really that many humans there. Where actually virtually none, no humans, and you're just studying lower forms of life, you can say that evolution is controlling just about everything around you. Thing he didn't do was he didn't, when he got back to England, say, huh, there's all these humans. Do my theories apply to all the humans? And that's where things get dicey, because humans have a very good understanding of the future, and therefore they can become evil and make decisions that go completely against God and become evil. Or they can make decisions that are completely against the way God functions, but not against God per se, and they become an atheist. So they then get illusioned, and their egotism prevents them from doing otherwise, because egotism is growing in the human race. As we develop more mental capacity and more mental consciousness, we also tend to become more egotistical, thinking that we're right and everybody else is wrong. Thank you very much. Or you could become arrogant. We're right and everybody else I don't care about. They're not just wrong. They are wrong. But I don't care that they're wrong. I don't care anything about them, so you're also non-loving. Okay. Those are the arrogant ones. Hopefully you're not like that. I doubt you are if you're listening to this show, because by now you would have switched to Station 2 or gone someplace else. Not to say Station 2 is bad. I'm just saying you would probably not want to be listening to me anymore. So, here's the point. This system, this energy kingdom system, starts off with God's answer at the very beginning of the whole process. Time, as it separates from space into the dimensions, has to eventually be brought back together for a life form to increase in consciousness. And it has to do that through senses that it uses in its form side to begin with, controlled hopefully by spirit that is somewhat enlightened. That produces the best result of joining time with space and overcoming forces. And life becomes more capable of surviving and prospering and being creative. Not just creative, but more of itself, or more of other life that it procreates, but literally being creative in all the kingdoms around it, and literally being beneficial, and literally being eventually not only very intelligent, but highly conscious, and seeking to be at least parts of it, is seeking to be its own creator. Not just worship its creator, but actually co-participate in what its creator is doing, because it learns its creator's purpose by literally involving itself in that purpose. It's a fascinating thing. And you can't just think about it. You've got to do more than thought. You've got to actually take action, because the three parts of God in its mind exist as an integral unit. Life, to be balanced and to reach higher levels of consciousness, has to be balanced within the three parts together. And that's brought together by the being itself, with the assistance of souls and some energy beings, which we're going to talk about. This is fascinating, isn't it? I really think it is. All right, so let's... I'm not going to go too much more with this stuff. I think we've covered enough of the science with the energy and the bank, the dimensions. We're going to get down to some of the more, we'll call it semi-practical elements, as much as you can buy into that. But I do want you to realize that the next thing we're going to be discussing has to do with the presumption, or at least my knowledge of, and your maybe doubting or accepting, that energy has consciousness. All energy has consciousness, not just, you know, certain kinds. But the consciousness is expressed based upon how much the energy informs either life or pre-life, and how much it is freed from the forces around it and able to express itself in time and space. Okay? So that's what we're looking for. Those are the quantitative, and there's mathematical formulas. You can write this whole thing out, just as I said it. If you're a physicist, all this can be converted into math. So it doesn't have to be the way I'm explaining it, but it would be a big chalkboard by the time you're done. But it can be done. All right, so now, let's look at this whole thing from a less scientific view and a more descriptive one. So energy is created from consciousness, but is its own thing. And it's the third part of God's mind. So in God's mental sphere, we'll call it, like, of course, God is not in the mental world, but in its sphere of mind, it produces three qualities. One of them is the first quality, which is of purpose and creation, sacrifice, freedom, it goes on and on. And the second part we call consciousness, or understanding, inclusiveness, kind of a universal form of love. Those kinds of things are the second. When you add those two together and you balance them out, and if they're a very high quality, meaning that they can affect the third thing, which is energy, to a large extent, those two together are called thought. When they're balanced, they affect energy more, and when they are balanced and fairly high in thought, they affect energy tremendously, because energy follows thought greater than its own. And the types of energy that most people are familiar with have very limited thought, whereas there are some parts of energy that think more and better than human beings. Wow. So the realm of the kingdom of energy is a unique realm that does something extremely special. It provides the vehicle for the diversity of life, while it holds all life from becoming chaotic at the same time. This is a strange thing. It literally holds together the fabric of life within the whole universe by having part of its kingdom at the very highest levels of where form exists at all, which is called the highest part of the atmic plane, or some people call it the plane where spirits first exists, called a spiritual plane. But that particular plane, there is energy that exists on, and there's energy that exists where we are, in the dense physical realm, and it's all part of the energy kingdom. And it holds together the other dimensions and the other kingdoms because it's common. It's common to all of the other kingdoms. Yet at the same time, it adds diversity to the kingdoms because when segregated to a specific dimension or subdimension, it becomes unique to that dimension because of its very characteristics of affecting or interrelating with time and space. And it's absolutely remarkable. And speaking about this from a physics standpoint, this is truly remarkable. And some beings have energy from all the dimensions of form and consciousness even beyond some of those dimensions. Some beings have that. Some beings just have consciousness on all the dimensions of form, which is pretty amazing, from the atmic down to the physical world. Others have it from the atmic to the middle. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. Amazing. Now, what does this mean? Well, the idea is, eventually, the highest parts of the energy kingdom join with the lowest parts, and humans eventually join and contribute to this lowest part at the same time with purely energy beings that reach from the atmic to the highest part of the middle world. Wow! All that happens. And by joining together, the life, quote-unquote, form, which also lives as a non-form, because it goes back to the monadic state, but now that monadic state is connected for the first time to these lower dimensions directly. Not just through its thought, but now it has bodies and it's grown all this stuff. It's an amazing thing. That is how you become God. That's how you, in order to become God, you have to grow yourself into all energy existing in all these lower subdimensions, eventually reach the monadic dimension, and then ascend that monadic dimension to the God dimension or logoic dimension, and reach the point where you experience God, and you have to do it in all three parts of time, obviously, at the same time, and in a virtual sense, experience the entire universe, past, present, and future, just as God eventually will. God's waiting around for that, so to speak, but at the same time is experiencing what everyone... Every being who ever does this does both. It's totally amazing. But God, greater than any being could possibly be, still there's a grand resemblance between what the beings that do this are like and what God itself is, except it's way, way more diverse and greater, because no matter how a being projects the future, it's still relatively a unique situation. Whereas God is the container of all the uniquenesses given back to it for its great sacrifice in creating life. But in time sense, it's going to be the entire universe's time for that to take place. Some elements with that we could call super sacrificial, but in other ways, it's tremendously meaningful and creative. It's a fascinating way of examining it. Okay, so the energy kingdom is unique because the beings in the energy kingdom can exist in all different realms at the same time, or they can exist extremely segregated into a very, very small part of even a subdimension. Some of them are called sub-subdimensions. You can imagine that in the monastic realm, a mental realm. So here we go. How does all this then come out in terms of specifics? What are these energy beings like? Well, when the energy first manifests itself in the atmic realm, its purpose is to not develop higher consciousness, but to develop lower consciousness, but a more dense form for life. So it sacrifices its own development of consciousness for the needed forms for life. It has to choose to do this. God doesn't force it. Nobody forces it. Some energy may not choose to do that. You might say, whoa, wait a second. It doesn't choose to do that? That's right. Some of the energy says, yeah, a lot of it does. It says, I'll go down to lower dimensions. Some of it will stay in the atomic world. A lot of it will go down to the Buddhic and some to the mental and the astral and eventually the dense physical, etheric and dense physical. That's all well and good. As it does, it loses consciousness, but it gains density and mass and increases in the thing we call gravity. Gravity is the collective consciousness. It grows in collective consciousness, but it loses almost all individual consciousness. Almost all. But some of the energy chooses not to do that. It says, hey, I don't want to lose consciousness. You know what? I think I'll stick around up here. And it forms an alliance with some of the energy that goes down one layer, down to the Buddhic realm, at the top of the Buddhic realm, and it says that some of that energy says, now, I'm not going. Some of it's going to stay at the top of the Buddhic realm, and it joins with the stuff that's at the top of the Atmic realm. And then finally, in this scenario, some of the energy goes to the mental realm, and it stops. It says, I don't want to go any lower than the top of the mental realm, and it commiserates with its other energies that are now slightly at different phases from it, so it has to form like a triangle to reach them, but it's able to muster enough of its self to be able to reach the frequency common to the realm above it. And literally, because the frequencies are still at a different phase, you actually, in three dimensions, build a triangle, something more like a pyramid if we really look at it. But in any case, it builds this, and the three together become somewhat unified and eventually create themselves into a thing called a solar angel. Oh, so that's how you do it. Yeah, that's how they do it. No, we don't do that at all, but that's how energy beings who are magnificent beings that are far and away more conscious than human beings manage to pull that off. Now, why do they stay so conscious? Well, because they're not going below the higher mental world. They're not even going below the first subworld of the higher mental world. They're in a very, very high state of what would be considered to be dimensionally consciousness. And so, to them, that's their natural state. They create this themselves, for themselves. They are self-created beings, and they come from monads. Now, the monads do not choose which energies do this. They let the energies decide if they're going to stay here or there or whatever. They create the energies and they create the spirit. When the energies join with the appropriate spirit that wants to join with it, then you got a new being called the solar angel, or some people call it the inner guide. Some people prefer, you know, like a energy kingdom master. There's a lot of different things. But okay, so you got those folks. Those beings being created, they never were or are human. They never are going to truly be human. Humans are going to eventually join with one of these beings, but they themselves have their own individual consciousness. But they are kind of they're kind of able to join together in a very strong way in group consciousness as well. So to them, they still carry a lot of the monadic sense of joined consciousness whenever they choose. Monads are much less individual than other forms of life, but they still have some individuality. But they grow in it tremendously through the forms of life they help to create. Same would be true of God. So the interesting thing of this is that it's a process becoming more and more individual, both from diversity and through the rejoining of time from space, but the first separation of time and space, and the rejoining them, which creates a future. There would be no future if time did not separate from space and it didn't go back together. The future would cease to exist. Okay. Getting back to my explanation. All right. So the first beings we should take note of are these super energy beings. Now, they actually have developmental things they do. The first is they develop the ability to communicate with their monads, which is important. So the highest part of the solar angel develops a connection, fairly strong connection with the monad to know what its plans are for life and that sort of thing. And then the rest of it develops as it works on developing a connection to a soul. A soul, either a group soul, and that's the majority of the time, or a individual human soul, to help that, assist that soul in helping to develop life. The soul itself is a joining of, it's called a balancing act, but it's a joining of the two elements of the energy king, two sides of the energy king. The soul's job is to try to develop life in the lower worlds, the lower mental, the astral, and the etheric physical, that balances eventually the consciousness and the development of the solar angel. That's the soul's job. The solar angel assists the soul and rarely assists any life forms directly except like very advanced humans. But, well, it's not even true. It does assist humans in some ways. We have a conscience that's related specifically to the solar angel, but it doesn't do any, it doesn't think for us. A lot of people think that solar angels think for us. They don't. And neither does the soul in reality. The soul only does so when we prompt it to do so and when we give it the access overpowering or overcoming our personality who wants to be in control of it. But the point is that the soul is a separate being. Wow. Now, where did the soul come from? People go, oh, okay, you tell us where the solar angels come from. Where do these souls come from? Well, here's the point. The soul is not on the first subline. There's parts of the same energy that made the solar angel, as it was going down, that went a little bit further. It went to the middle of the second subplane of the mental world, called the fourth subplane, and it stops there. And some of it all goes further down, and that's going to create all kinds of other life. They're called group souls. It goes to the third subplane. They're going to create all kinds of other life and some parts of pre-life. But the part that creates human beings is going to stop on the second subplane, one subplane higher in consciousness. And that part, okay, gets spirit that spills off of, if you want to call it that, not used by the solar angel. That spirit is of lower level of consciousness, and it joins with the energy, and the two get balanced really good, but they aren't very conscious, and there's a reason for that. The soul has almost no sense, except in this extremely narrow range of the fourth subplane of the second subplane of the monastic world, whereas comparison-wise, the solar angel has consciousness spanning from the highest part of the mental world to the highest part of the atmic world. Huge difference in consciousness. Remember, dimensionally, consciousness grows as you have more of it, not less. And so the soul is at the beginning of its existence, and for a large period of time, whether it's a group soul on the third sub-world or a human soul on the second, very narrow range of consciousness because it doesn't have any sense except where its realm is, and its realm is extremely narrow down to a sub-subplane part of the middle one. That's a very small place to have sense. And the soul has to borrow some sense from the solar angel on occasion that helps it to gain better understanding, consciousness, beyond its abilities. And it does that usually for the first kinds of life it helps to create, because if it didn't, life would not survive very often. Too many errors. Now, the soul then creates life that eventually has life in the lower worlds, in the astral, the etheric and physical worlds, and that life has its own senses and its own realm of consciousness. Sometimes that life is connected to an individual soul like us. Sometimes it's connected to a group soul that it shares the consciousness of the same soul with others and has instincts. We don't have instincts. I know people think we do. But we have drives, which is a whole thing dealing with how the personality is designed. I'm not going to get into that for tonight. And we don't have instincts, which are complex patterns of behavior. All of our behaviors are simplistic that have drives associated with them, but not complex. Complex is like a couple turkeys doing a turkey trot before we mate. We don't go out and do the turkey trot unless we've learned it. But the turkeys do it without learning. Now, there's some people, I would think, with their consciousness where it is, they might be turkeys. But regardless of that subject, the general state of human beings is that we have an individual soul that doesn't give us much in the way of preconceived thinking, which is what instincts are, preconceived thought. We have to conceive the thought we have ourselves, and our soul doesn't exactly help us in that process because it doesn't have enough sense of us to be very accurate in that. We can eventually develop our soul as we develop ourselves, and then our soul can help us think, and then it's a huge, huge plus. All right, so I hope this is starting to make some sense here. Now, so we have the energy that isn't part of the solar angel anymore, but it has become souls. And those souls help to create life in the lower realms. And they're all part of the energy kingdom. But the energy is becoming more dense, harder for spirits to have influence on. Remember, energy follows thought greater than its own, and the thought of spirit, as it lowers itself, becomes less of itself, less thought, and more disorganized. Now, why does that happen? Well, because time is separating from space, because of the dimensional issues of the relationship of energy to time and space. And so as it separates from space, it becomes more and more difficult to think, and more difficult to use any sub-level of the monastic realm higher than where one is found, one is existing. So once you get to the lower dimensional realm, the energy that exists there is suddenly no longer able to be a conscious entity. It can't be a conscious entity on its own. And spirit can no longer govern the energy at 100% level. So the energy doesn't follow spirit's thought very well. And it's only as spirit develops a lot of consciousness that it transfers over to the energy, and then that's shared with the soul, does all of the system work to the benefits. Before that, which could be, in human terms, a number of lifetimes, there's a disconnect, both between the soul and the human, and other factors. During those lifetimes, the solar angel becomes an assistant. It helps create the conscience thread. So we have a conscience. We know right and wrong. It's like preconceived thought again, but we know right and wrong just by the solar angel thinking it for us, which is helpful, very helpful, but it doesn't give us as much a chance to grow than if we don't just do things because we feel and think in a preconceived way, but rather we deduce it, and in the deduction of it and the eventual induction and models that we create, it becomes a part of us anew. Because then you have taken the preconceived thought, and now, even though you still have a conscience, you don't really use it as much as you create more of what the minimal conscience is of the solar angel. Now, you're going to say, well, why didn't the solar angel just give us the consciousness of a master? Yeah, it doesn't work like that because consciousness has to be maintained by sense. The master's senses are all unified and all enlightened. A human's senses are not only not unified, they're usually pretty dark, and they're also not very well developed if you're a beginning human being. So a beginning in terms of number of lifetimes you've had. So it's a really dicey subject that the solar angel cannot, in a physics sense, cannot give us more consciousness than we have sense. Got it? So a person's conscience is somewhat, at all times, related to their ability to perceive. We actually know this. And let me explain how we know this. You take two different people. One is a very young soul, maybe, or maybe one that's gone astray. It doesn't matter. Has low consciousness. And you take another human being with high consciousness. We attribute less responsibility to the behaviors of people with lower consciousness. We do it subconsciously, but it's sometimes reflected in the way we uphold laws and do other things. And we say that in our minds, someone who is of lower consciousness, we expect less from. Even though if conscience were absolute, we should expect the same from either, but it isn't. They have different consciences, and we subconsciously perceive that. It's an interesting thing. How do I know this? Because that's how society has created itself. And society is created through the consciousness of all of its members. So that's what's happening. It just is the way it is. And you can see this throughout the world. It's not like one country or another. There are some countries where it's more pronounced than others. But that has to do with the bias that some people have towards one kind of way of thinking and another. Still, it's there. And so fascinating. The solar angel can only give us as much conscience as we can use our senses to be responsive to. And we call that being able to be responsible or responsibility. So our responsibility goes up as our senses increase, which also causes or allows us to create more consciousness, and our conscience becomes stronger. Unless we choose to ignore it. What happens? You get a lot of messages from that old solar angel. It uses this what's called the first thread, and it comes piping in, and you say, you know what? I don't care about that. Well, every time you ignore the conscience, you take a ding in your consciousness, and the result is that the joining together of the consciousness becomes split apart. Conscience is conscience, okay? Science is to bring together and to find truth. So you lose consciousness, it spreads it out, and you lose the ability to tell the truth and also find the truth in others. When you ignore your conscience. Whoa! Didn't know that, huh? Yeah, and it's because you're blocking that message. You create forces inside your senses, and your senses are actually starting to split apart. Maybe not very much, but a little bit. If you fully split the consciousness of a center from the form, you die in that body. Only one center. That's all it takes, you die. The reason you die is they take so many senses to maintain the life form. Any life form that you remove a sense from, it can't support that kind of life anymore, and therefore the life leaves that body. Okay, so fascinating stuff. All right, so how does this all work out then? We've got this conscience thing and other stuff, but what's going on with the rest of the energy? Because I'm going to leave that part alone. Now we're going to move where energy goes, where human beings don't notice any longer what's happening because they have a misunderstanding of what energy is. So energy gets more and more dense, and it starts to gravitate. That means that as it densifies, its thought is to listen to only itself or its own brethren of common energies, and this causes them to join together. But it also excludes it from joining in into life forms very easily, and spirit starts losing more and more of that ability to do so. So it becomes harder to create the form of life as you go lower and lower. And life itself becomes more difficult as you get lower and lower, but also more diverse. So we could say that one of the things the energy kingdom does is that it makes more life more forceful and difficult, but it vastly increases diversity at the same time. So there's a payoff and there's a penalty for living in lower forms of life, including human, because that life is regrettably very forceful, particularly as you reach the densest levels, which is the etheric, dense physical, or electromagnetic and physical matter part of the universe. And when that occurs, a life form gets more diverse, but it also becomes separated from others of its kind more, which leads to a faster development of individuality, but a loss of group consciousness. But that's in comparison to the energy itself. What is it doing? It's becoming more group conscious, but it's losing all of its individual consciousness. So you've got a being, like a human being, I'm using us because we're so familiar with us, but you can use other forms of life, in the physical world, which is becoming enormously individual over time, but at the same time, it's using energy that has lost this ability. And you say, well, why? How does that affect the energy kingdom? Well, this is the trick. You're going to love this. The energy that is brought into the human form as our senses, and that's the highest quality of energy in our body, the physical body or any body, the senses. That sense energy, when the person dies, and in some circumstances, as they grow in consciousness and exchange the energy that is in their senses for new energies that are a little more conscious, usually coming from other human beings, by the way, consciousnesses can be transferred that way from one person to another. That energy, as it develops like that, starts becoming more conscious again. It actually turns the corner and becomes more conscious. It doesn't have to be just for humans, though. Humans do a great job with it. But any form of life can do this. Any form. And so the energy kingdom turns the corner. It reaches what is called the greatest level of involution, which just means losing consciousness, becoming more dense, and thinking in terms of gravity. Let's get together. And by becoming part of the senses of other life, especially human life, it turns around and becomes evolutionary again. Evolutionary. Again, it starts growing back up again with life itself. And you say, whoa. So it reaches the densest form, which is parts of some elements, and then it is turned around by becoming senses in various things. And it's become, even becomes senses, in, believe it or not, in the elements, but it's a very limited sense. And then life eventually turns it around, and it becomes evolution. We are part of how the energy kingdom interrelates with us. Are you following me? I hope so. All right. Because, you know, we've only got about an hour left. All right. So let's go on. I think this story is so interesting because, actually, I've never read anything that explains it this way, and it should, because it's all one. That's once you start seeing the unity of life, you can experience God a lot easier. And you can see that this system certainly was never created by chaos. Okay, so the next step in this process is that this new life that of the energy, okay, now I'm not talking about the human system, I'm talking about the energy itself, has an evolutionary context to it. And there actually there's a sub-kingdom of energy with a name. It's called Devonic Energy. Devonic. demonic energy. And that energy is evolutionary, and there's two different classes of demonic energy that humans deal with. One of them is called the lunar class, and the other is called the solar class. Oh, this sounds interesting. Okay. So the lunar class of energies is the class in which the consciousness of the energies is a reflection of the solar class. So the consciousness is a lower level of consciousness, but a reflective form of it, similar to that of the solar class. Okay, got that so far? But it, you know, the system has to start somewhere, right? So how does that happen? Well, we're going to get to the solar answer in a second. And then you end up with the solar class of angels, some of which, right, are growing from the lunar class, and some begin the process as being affected directly by the solar angel. The solar class of energies that aren't part of the solar angel all exist from the top of the second subworld of the middle world down, because the solar angel doesn't go any lower than that in its consciousness. But it has an effect on those energies through various bridges and things. And it is a major effect when the solar angel is not yet a human solar angel and is working in the lowest kingdoms, especially the mineral kingdom. When it's doing so, it may have an effect on a relatively young planet for helping the more conscious, potentially conscious parts of energy to develop themselves, because there has to be something pulling you up as well as the self-created level, or you would have too much of what is called evolutionary effect, and not enough, which creates a lot of forces, and not enough of the consciousness of God itself coming into play. So if it wasn't for the solar angels doing this, life would take on a much more evolutionary pattern, but it would be 10 times as long, if not longer, to develop life, and it would have many catastrophes. In some cases, just by chance, some planets would not succeed in developing life. So that's not a very good system, and God decided that that system wasn't going to work. But it didn't want it to be deterministic, so it developed the energy kingdom, which intervenes in the process by it being a co-development of life in itself, and the interplay between the energy and form sides and spirit itself creates the three parts of God, and it makes the whole thing work without God having to go in and say, do this, do that, and everything else. Everything has its own individual sphere and can develop individuality and consciousness. Even the solar parts of energy that are not part of a solar angel have individual levels of consciousness. And you could say, well, what does a solar being look like, a divinic being that's solar, that isn't a solar angel? I can't exactly tell you that. Now, why not? Because dimensionally, they don't exist in the lower mental world, and I've had no experiences of sense, in direct sense, of anything in the higher mental world. So I can't exactly describe it on any kind of what's called responsive level. But what I know of it, it's a difference in experience, these beings have a existence not too different from a soul, so it's a correspondence of a soul, and they deal with virtual reality, and they also add, when a certain bridge is developed, called the Antikorana or Rainbow Bridge, they add a tremendous amount to the ability of the soul to comprehend experiences it's gathered from the lower dimensions of time and space, because they are connected to the lunar demons directly. So they have an interconnection that the soul doesn't have. And so the lunar parts of the energies, yeah, from the lower mental down, those energies are reflecting much in consciousness of what they gain from their solar counterparts, while they themselves are trying to grow their consciousness and overcome their tendency still to maybe not be as individual thinking and to be too group conscious at times. And they fall into both sides, depending upon how well the being that is using them has consciousness. Not the level in absolute terms, but the relative level in comparison to the ability to respond through their senses. So let's take a look at that. A human being, say, that is using some of the lunar devas and some of the solar ones as well, has a limited ability to create concepts with the solar devas when it first develops itself as a human being from a human soul. But it has greater ability to create thought forms, and those solar angels are affecting the ability for the thought forms to be made out of lunar devas. Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah, the lunar devas are making the thought forms, the solar devas are making the concepts. And beginning humans work in a very limited concept, mostly from the third subplane. And the interesting part about this is that we have a major impact on the development of some of these lunar devas. They have a dependency on being part of our senses. We bring them in so that they can gain a sense of the world that we're using. While we use our senses, they are developing. Well, that's true, right? The more you use a sense, we call it practice, the better it becomes. Don't use a sense, and guess what? It atrophies. And it's not the sense that's atrophying. It's the energy that's in the sense that is atrophying. Are you following? You say, well, what about the reflective quality coming from the solar devas? Should that help? No. Once the energy becomes part of our sense, the solar deva energy, the reflection, is only as much as we allow. If we keep the senses getting very dense reactions and tremendous forces in them and thinking dark thoughts and dark ways and acting dark thoughts and dark ways, the result is that most of the reflection that the lunar devas get isn't there, and so they go dark. Literally, in our etheric body, they become very dark, and it becomes a thing called Maya. Looks like dark shadows and eventually black. Wow. Yeah, it's true. Some people can actually see that. It's possible to do that. So as amazing as it sounds, all this sounds like some kind of great fantasy story to some folks, I'm sure. But this really is how it works. It's how the system works. The energy kingdom is the most complex kingdom to explain because there are so many moving parts, literally. And there's so many things that are uncommon to the human experience. I mean, when we talk about masters, you know, most people can relate to that because it's, okay, it's still a human kind of thing. I got it. But this isn't a human kind of thing at all. This is an energy thing. And the energy kingdom is fascinating, but very complex. Okay, so you can say, well, then there must be different classes of lunar energies and solar. Yeah, there are. As a matter of fact, if you really get into the devonic elements of the kingdoms, that's where the diversity is greatest. There's in comparison to the involutionary energies. The thing that's so amazing about them, these evolutionary energies, is they have a huge realm of different classifications. Some of them become connected as semi-beings of their own right, and some don't. Some become attached to only doing 5 or 10 kinds of things because they specialize in a certain series of senses in animals or humans or plants. and they then attach themselves more to that type of form. They get very used to it. Sometimes they stay outside the sense of the plant, but assist the sense of the plant. Now, that's where the whole theory of fairies and elves and all that stuff came from. Do they really exist in the way we metamorphize them as more humankind? No. They are energy beings. As a matter of fact, a plant, David, looks nothing like a human being. Not even in a close, you're not even close to that. There's some pictures of those in Lights and Meaning. I mean, they're just very unique, but they're not anything like what we call human or form type of thing. You're not going to see them carrying a pot of gold and, you know, whistling down the road. And they don't make horror pictures either. So I think the thing that's most fascinating about this is we have, you know, made this our own anthropomorphic kind of effect because we can't understand it, but some others have discovered this in ages past, told us about this stuff, as I'm telling you now, but maybe not so scientifically, and we've taken it and made it into these fables because there's no other way to explain it, especially to young people. It's just too complicated and too hard to understand. There's too much to really have to have a foundation in. I assume a lot of you have read something I've written or some other kinds of material, and you've listened to maybe some shows before. I make that assumption, and I realize there are new listeners possibly in every show. But the point is that there's no other way to do this. You know, I can't restart the show every time. Well, we're going to start from the beginning because we never get anywhere. But anyway, okay, so the fascinating part of this is that there's literally thousands of individual kinds of classes of devonic energies, especially when you get to the lunar Deva class. There's less of that in the solar realm, but far more in lunar. And the way to compare it is how many concepts, different kinds of concepts are there compared to different kinds of thought forms. Huge number of thought forms possible. A lot of concepts, but not anywhere near the same number. All right. The factor of this is that, again, the energy kingdom is adding diversity, but it's also keeping the kingdoms and each kingdom unified, protected in some respects, and we'll call it, amazingly, I would call it organized. Now, the organization does not detract from, and this is the tremendous genius of this plan, organization that does not detract from diversity is almost a godly, unique idea. In most human endeavors, organization detracts from diversity. Now, even when it's organization for the benefits of diversity, it will detract from it in some ways. Only God came up with a plan that doesn't require that, or doesn't cause that. All right. So, let's talk about, I'm not going to go through the thousands. I mean, it would be endless almost, and you would get bored over time, I think. But, you know, people say, well, why don't you write a book about everything you know about? I mean, it would be impossible to read it because just describing a few of these states of devonic energy is enough to for most people to be mind-boggling. You imagine a thousand. But I'll go into a couple so we have a flavor for it. Let's talk about some of the plant lunar devas. Actually, each group of plants has their own specialized devonic creature. Okay, that it isn't just plants. It's think about how many plants there are in the world. Okay, and each kind of plant, almost by species. Species has its own senses, unique senses, and amazingly, its own lunar devas, and some solar that are different as well. Now, the solar ones sometimes share different lunar ones that have some similarity, but the lunar ones, they're just off separately from all the other ones. The little ones are really gaining a lot of individuality, if you think about it, because they're becoming this planet and that planet. When I say becoming, they affect and eventually become part of the senses of the plants. Now, plants have anywhere from 3 or 4 senses or so. Most of them have 3. And the sense, 2 in the etheric realm and 1 in the astral. And they need to exchange energy from both dimensions in order for there to be life. That's a definition of how you know if something's alive or not alive. And so the plants don't have an easy time, to say the least, exchanging energy between dimensions because they're not animated for the most part. That's why we call animals animals and plants plants. They're planted. They don't move. Animals are active, so they're animated. But just using English words to describe it. So they have a hard time, and it's not their fault. they just, it's the nature of the plant that causes the problem. But the energies that are not part of their sense that become these little energy beings, some of them are, we call them divinic beings, help to communicate from one plant to another via the astral world. Well, how do they do that? Well, let's talk about blades of grass for a minute. I like keeping it simple, all right? You have about 5, let's say you get 5 blades of grass. Okay. And they need to know what all the other blades of grass are doing because they have the effect of them. One blade of grass affects the other blades of grass because collectively they're living as a unit more than they are individuals. And so they don't have this great ability to use the astral world very effectively. Normally a plant uses the astral world to communicate with one part of itself and another part fairly effectively. I'll give you a tree as an example. The leaves of the tree communicate with the branches and the trunk and the roots by more of the astral world sense, which is usually a single sense, with the 2 etheric world senses, which is the more denser parts of the plant. But the astral part is an energy that we're not familiar with. And the plant has a sort of feeling. And you say, well, wait a second. Plants don't have no feelings. I know they don't have no feeling. Well, there's sort of a truth to that, because they have the kind of feeling we have, or an animal has. You've got to have 3 full senses in the astral world. And because, in some cases it can be 2, but it's usually 3. And the energy has to move back and forth, you see, in order to feel movement, and that's what we call feeling. Plants don't feel the movement of energy from themselves and something else. They only feel the energy, movement of energy from within themselves. Got the difference? Okay. So, but they do feel, that means, but they don't feel pain. Now you say, well, how do we know we don't feel pain? Well, in order to feel pain, you have to feel the difference between the energy outside yourself and the energy inside yourself. A little complicated equation, but that's the only way you could do it, because pain is the level of diminishment of energy moving in and out of yourself. Plants don't have that astrally, so they don't feel astral pain. What about etherically? Well, etheric pain is a real thing, and plants sense that by having a lack of vitality and a loss of life. So they do feel that in a sense. But it's that limited sense that isn't the kind of pain we're used to. They don't have feelings the way we have, and they don't have pain the way we have. So we, for most part, humans assume, and it's pretty much true, that plants don't feel the kind of pain we feel. And the pain they do feel isn't the kind that causes suffering, per se. It just leads to a diminishment of life. It's called stress. Many people that are into plants say the plant is stressed. Well, that's when it's feeling pain. It isn't able to communicate within parts of itself. All right. So these creatures, we'll call them lunar devas, are doing 2 things. the plants can't communicate between each other because they don't have an astral sense. It does that. They would need more sense, more astral sense than they have. So they use some of that. They help the blades of grass, as an example, know what the other blades are experiencing and to better prepare for it. You find that hard to believe. Okay, well, listen, I'll explain more about it and you think about it. What does this mean in terms of how grass grows, then? Well, grass grows by the, let's say you have a patch of grass, and you don't water it. Well, does it all turn brown at the same time? Nope. Have you noticed that? It tends to move from one side to another. Why does it do it that way? Well, because it keeps the grass alive. That's the most possible by doing it that way. If it all kind of just changed at the same time, it would all die at the same time. And you just don't see that happening. It doesn't all die at the same time, does it? That's because, now, it can happen so fast that we may not notice this, but if you watch it carefully, you'll see what I'm saying. That's because it is connected through the astral sense. That helps it to understand what's going on with grass that may be feet away from it. Now, it's limited. The devas that work with grass, they don't cover huge areas. They cover small places. But even though the moisture in the ground is identical in two different locations, feet apart, the grass doesn't die all at the same time in the same way. And it doesn't grow all at the same time in the same way either. Amazing stuff. Amazing. Yes, if you plant grass and it is perfectly watered and perfectly cared for, it may actually grow close to the same time. Not always. Not really. Okay, so here we go. We've got these devas that are helping that way, and they do something really unique. They sometimes directly enter into the sense of the blade of grass or the tree, and they help the communication between the etheric centers and the astral. They actually can do that. It gives them a big factor of, we'll say, experiencing being like a sense of the plant, because they've already been that before. And at the same time, they can leave and go about on the outside. So they're preparing themselves to become the senses of animals and or eventually to even, with some animals, some forms of animals, a lot of them actually, the devonic energies also do things for animals. Now you can say, oh, well, how come we don't know that? Well, because we just don't. We don't recognize that animals have senses coming from these devonic energies that additionally help them to do things like know more about what others are doing in a herd someplace at the back of the herd from the front and other kinds of things like that than the normal senses that they might have by our understanding of sense. Because this is an extension of sense. Now, you could say, well, come on, how can you prove this? Well, I don't know if I have to prove it, but the point is that it would be helpful to probably suggest some experiments that you might want to do. You might want to try working with rats in cages. Well, I hate that idea, but and see if a rat from one cage can sense a rat from another cage. Can your dog know when you're blocks away from coming home at a different time than you normally come home, maybe a mile or two? Does a dog react sometimes? How does it do that? What happens is it's using its astral sense, but that astral sense, which is pretty good in a dog, by the way, is further augmented sometimes by devonic energy as well, which can really help. And there's some humans that can do this. Oh, wow, is that weird. Humans that can use devonic energies? I thought we're individualized. We don't do that. Well, so people have damage to some of their individual parts of themselves, and because of that damage, they actually rely upon this other thing more, and we call them psychic kinds of people. But they're actually doing some of this. It's weird. It's weird. It's what we call sometimes sixth sense or extrasensory perception, etc. A lot of extrasensory perception is using demonic energy. And those people usually are treated well by demonic beings. Most demonic beings find humans to be obnoxious because we don't use them and because we harm the creatures that they try to protect and help. So we're not the friends of this particular part of the energy kingdom. Generally speaking, they don't try to harm us back, but you can be if you directly influence or try to affect the consciously try to affect a lunar day, but not just do it by blunder. You may get a very bad response. It can actually upset your etheric nervous system and cause you to become disorganized, not thinking very well. Your senses could be diminished for a time. I mean, it's not going to be a permanent thing, but at least not, hopefully. I mean, if you keep doing it, maybe you keep whacking yourself that way. It's sort of like going through electroconvulsive shock. Eventually, you may not have a brain left. You fry things on the inside, too. Because energy follows thought, and brain is energy, so you end up starting going the wrong way. If your energy is that nasty that you want to upset the life of some poor tree or something, it's safer to cut down a tree than it is to go to the deva that's helping it and try to mess with that thing. Those devas, by the way, are as big or bigger than the tree itself. And they have enormous amounts of lunar deva energy inside of them. They also contain almost no involutionary energy. So they are pure energy beings. They look pretty amazing. If you can see them, if you have some level of etheric vision, some psychics can see them. And when we talk about auras, that's etheric energy that surrounds a human being. Some of that energy is composed of lunar deva energy. Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah, so we do have some lunar deva energy that's working in our senses outside of ourselves, in our etheric body. But that energy is so connected to us that it seldom is running around between us and something else. But if you stay close to people, they can start sharing some of the energy. Honestly. Isn't that weird? Did you ever think that that might really be happening with some people you really spend a lot of time with and are quite close? Maybe when you get married or have a really intense relationship. Yes, and your senses can start being shared. Once you start sharing senses, you eventually can start sharing thought. That's an interesting idea. Yeah, as a matter of fact, if you start sharing senses between at least two of the three bodies, the etheric and the astral, the result can be some level of lower mental sharing of thought. Even though the mental body may not be directly shared. Usually then, it's only in the past part of time, so you can't think together at the same time, but you can think very close to what the other person was thinking. Interesting. Now, if you both went to the mental world together, you could do that. But usually not while you're physically incarnate. Nonetheless, fascinating idea, huh? All right, so we do rely upon some of the more advanced lunar deva energies, and they are not as succinctly distinct beings as plant devas are or animal devas are. And when in some religions they talk about animal spirit, well, that spirit connected to etheric lunar deva energy. And that spirit and lunar deva energy is able to separate itself and still exist as a separate entity even when the animal dies. And one of the reasons that people who can live by eating animals in their religion, which is usually correct, by the way, spiritually they believe that you need to be kind and be thankful for the life you're taking, so that the spirit and lunar deva energy don't find you so obnoxious that it does that number I talked about earlier and harms you in some way. American Indians have that. There's a number of other people throughout the world. Most of them have a stronger spiritual understanding of the physical world around them, but it doesn't mean they have a greater understanding of science or anything. They have a greater understanding of that part of existence, and they respect it because they believe it has absolute reality to them. They've seen it happen over and over again, and they now are convinced that if you live this way, you get these results. You live this other way, you get much more negative ones. And, of course, they see people come in, like the people from Europe came over to the New World and infiltrated their civilizations. And immediately what they noticed was, boy, oh, boy, they got all this dark energy they're taking in because the good energy is being pushed out because they kill wantonly. They just go sport hunting and do kill for no reason at all. And in addition, they have no gratitude to anything for what they kill. And they also do many other dark things. And so as a result of this, they can see it. Nothing made them more convinced of their spiritual religion than to have the results so apparent for those who didn't have a spiritual life. Weird as it sounds, we actually strengthen some spiritual religions. But the point is, we also usurp them. We say, well, our way of seeing spirit is this. Spirit's in this being, this person, maybe Jesus Christ, maybe Muhammad, whoever you want to believe, the prophet. But the thing is that it's not that it's so bad. It's that you've got to take this instead of the spiritual understanding you have. Now that's where a lot of contentious issues start coming in. It's okay to add to it. Not so good to tell people you can't think that way, can't live that way. Because again, actually, you create more consternation among the spiritual parts of life that makes life more forceful and more difficult. The people who have that attitude bring upon themselves a more difficult world in which to live. Forces increase tremendously. It'll be harder to get crops to grow. It'll be harder to find good water. It'll be harder to do almost everything that is the basis of life if you are ill-conceived in your approach about life itself, and especially if you don't have a good conscience. Interesting ideas here. Interesting. Okay, so the lunar deva, there's many, many different kinds. You can have just every species could have its own group of lunar devas, and some of them eventually can become in some ways connected to human beings because we have energy, lunar deva energy within ourselves, in our centers. But that energy is so hopefully well-balanced with our consciousness, it's not going to go running off very easily. We may exchange it for more enlightened energy or, unfortunately, become darker, depending upon our choices to either create enlightenment and create light in the world, virtue, or to not create a darker place. And that directly corresponds to our bodies. Because energy follows thought greater than its own. Now, some people say, well, why isn't it much harder then to become darker because the energy won't follow your thought? Well, that's a safeguard, yes, and it's called one of the options of grace. God created it that way, so you can make some mistakes without really going off the deep end very fast. You decline slowly, at least in the beginning of the process, because the devas don't follow that very easily. So it really takes some effort to become dark. Now, if you take in time into account and you keep doing it over and over again, eventually you will become dark. But we have the opportunity to change. Just let it happen by being creative of virtue instead of creative of evil or darkness, which could lead to evil. So this is the process. It is fascinating to look at the converse of what I just said. Actually, it's the inverse, but I'll explain why. The ability to grow the sense is actually better in most people through improving consciousness than is the, I'll call it ability, but we'll call it the likelihood of diminishing a sense is by being selfish. So everything is pointed in the direction of growth and development because of that. So the system is stacked, let's say. God said, I'm not going to throw the dice here. I want it to be my game. My game is I want to enlighten the world. And so I'll create a system in where, since energy follows thought greater than its own, if your thought is greater than the energy, it'll follow it better. And if it's a higher quality, which we call consciousness, which is part of thought, so greater thought has to have higher consciousness associated with it after a certain point, then the amazing thing about this is that the speed at which the sense improves is relatively greater than the speed at which it diminishes in most circumstances. Didn't know that. And that's true in animals and plants as well, although they have less of a culpability for there being true individual motivation for their life. But regardless, the whole system is tilted towards God. From that one part of life, the entire system, now you've heard me say this many times, of course, but maybe you didn't understand why, because I couldn't explain why without going through 2.5 hours of a program. But so you see, it is tilted all towards the growth of God in comparison to the growth of evil. Now, evil is aware of this, believe it or not. Most evil is aware of this. But it has methodologies to try to circumvent the obvious, which is the system is rigged to eventually destroy itself. The evil will eventually destroy itself. Its consciousness keeps getting lower, even though it says it doesn't, it does. And and everyone that is growing their consciousness is growing faster than the people who are losing consciousness in general. But if evil can get strong enough, it can change the odds. Let me explain what happens. Normally, evil is interspersed on a planet in a fairly even way. What does that mean? Well, its effect on the energy kingdom is the same in the United States as it is, say, in Russia, and the same in Argentina, and maybe Australia, and maybe China. Effects are pretty much the same in those places as a place. But the consciousness of the leadership is what controls whether evil can or cannot change the system. Evil works only from the top down in a pyramid fashion. It goes after leaders. It doesn't particularly care. It doesn't initiate responses and use its energy on people who aren't in some leading role. It doesn't pay. It doesn't pan out because God's got all the odds, so it won't play that game. But it goes after the leaders, because if the people permit it, it will find a leader who doesn't want to do good but is evil, or at least prone to becoming evil, and I'll get that dude, usually it's a guy, in as a power figure and a control person, and they do the evil. Now, what do? They restrict freedom, they destroy consciousness, and eventually they make form destroyed by making forces, enormous forces, through restrictions and through usually decrees, and they'll call them laws, but they're really decrees of predetermined ways for people to live their life. Control, slavery is what we're really talking about. And so it's not abject slavery, it's kind of circumvented by flowery words, and we're really doing it for your best interest. You know. But at any rate, so evil looks for the opportunity to affect government because it's acting as the leading source of this sort of thing, and because it governs people, and then leaders in the governing bodies. And so it then has the upper hand because it's only through that one kind of methodology that it really has an advantage. You could say, well, what about businesses where they do bad things, you know, it balances out, unfortunately, for the businesses, and eventually they don't do well. They don't do well. They only do well when there is a dictatorship of sorts of government, and then bad businesses do well because they're in the payoff system. They support the leader, so they're just part of the governmental subterfuge going on. And then, yes, you could say businesses become that way in that sense. And particularly if it's a capitalistic system, as long as the government promotes monopolies, it has an anti-monopolistic attitude, so that everybody has some level of ability to compete, then the process is good for business and it provides a means of enlightenment. You still have to allow freedom in the businesses, but you just prevent one business from swallowing up in a predatory fashion all the other ones. This happened in the United States in the second half of the 19th century. It got very bad. So you see, there are some things the government does that are good, but the thing that evil is looking for is to take over the government and then get people to be fooled that the government's not evil. It's just doing it for their own good. And once it's got that hand on the throat of everybody, then the odds go the other way. So evil doesn't use itself in all countries equally. It goes after the countries that are most vulnerable at the time to take over. It'll spend a lot of energy in those areas and not pay much attention to some other ones. And as it goes, country by country, it can take over a world. It wants to always go after the single country that is the leading country, because that one is going to, that's like a domino effect. And then when that one goes, almost everything's going to falter. And the leading country in the world today still is the United States, and it is destroying that leadership role while it also is destroying the country. Now, why would it want to destroy the leadership role? Because isn't it true if the United States goes bad and it's a leading country, that will lead to other countries falling apart? Not exactly. Remember the problem that when the United States falls apart, assuming it's going to, if it does, then the rest of the world now has a keener sense of evil. It's more visible. It may react in a stubborn way, and it may give them more, we'll say, abilities to change what's going to be their reality as well. So there is some counter backlash to taking over the big banana, which is the United States. But if you can make it happen, and you can do it fast enough, and nobody knows it's evil, that's the biggest defense evil has, is you don't know it's there, or if you have an inkling it's there, but you think it's all everywhere else, then it's just going to win just as easily that way. But what it does do is this. It allows the system to manipulate the senses. Let me explain. We're getting back to the demonic issues now. That they, as evil controls the system, its design is to reduce the senses of people, ultimately. ultimately it's a reduced sense, so that even if people's consciousness doesn't dramatically fall as a result of the evil, as the sense is diminished, the consciousness can't be maintained. And it does over time. Remember, it takes a long time to diminish consciousness, longer than it takes to grow it. But if you do it in mass scale, you can achieve amazing results. And that's what evil does. Take a look at what happened to Germany. You know, within a matter of years, the consciousness of the nation fell. How did that happen? Because the senses of the nation fell. Oh, what, they created all those great airplanes and the blimps and the dirigibles and all that. They did a lot of that before the war, and then their senses started to diminish even before the first battle of World War II. How do we know this? Because we know that they made a huge number of, we'll call tactical, decisions that were in error. Goofy thing. They did some goofy things. I just saw a program where they made tanks that could go underwater. But they forgot that you couldn't get out of the tank if you were under the water, because the pressure of the water on the tank was too great. So people could run out of oxygen before they get out of the water. Anyway, that was a big problem. But there would be ways to accomplish them getting out of those tanks that they couldn't see. They couldn't even fathom how to do it, and there were lots of ways to do that. And so one of the people I know, his name's Scott, he came up with an idea, just put a bell down on the tank 20 feet below the water, and then people could get right out because the air pressure would equalize the tank pressure inside, and they could do it. It would overcome the water pressure. The pressure would go against the bell instead of against the door of the tank or the top of the door of the tank, and they could walk out of the tank. They didn't think of that. They actually killed dozens of people doing this goofy thing. But that's just one example. And that's not to say there aren't crazy stuff that the United States did in war, etc. But what I'm trying to explain is that despite all of the technology advancements that they had done, and the more the consciousness of the nation got involved with the war, not just the leadership, the more the consciousness of the people declined. So much so that some people became victims more easily. The Jews is an example. I mean, granted, terrible things were done to them, but they also allowed it to happen to some extent. People are, when they're afraid, that's one thing. But when you know you're going to die for sure, you know what's going on. I mean, most of them did. But, you know, they wanted to believe otherwise, but they really did know. You get up and you fight, because what the heck, if you're going to die, you might as well die for something that's good, particularly if your consciousness is high enough. But if you lower the consciousness of all the people, including the victims, it's easier to pick them off. So this system is diabolical because it deals with destroying effectively not just the human being, but a part of the Lunar Deva kingdom, making that part darker and cutting off its connection with the Solar Deva kingdom. That's what evil is. They want nothing to do with those Solar Devas whatsoever, and they want a system in which all of the energy is composed of dark lunar deva energy and involutionary energy. And that's what their bodies are actually made out of. And they actually crystallize. When there is no reflected light going into a lunar deva, and it's not in the act of creating light, it becomes it crystallizes. It becomes tenaciously holds on to what it is. So their consciousness won't drop as fast. But it also, unfortunately, at the same time, it just messes up the senses ridiculously, and consciousness drops too. So evil is out to destroy a kingdom many people don't even know about, of life, energy itself. As a matter of fact, no one abuses energy more than dark people. One way or another, they abuse forms of energy in massive ways. They waste it, but besides wasting it, they use it in the most absurd ways to not help life, but to hurt life and restrict its growth. Unbelievable. So they work against the entire David Kingdom. Tell me that isn't an amazing idea. And unfortunately, the evil folk are very knowledgeable of what I'm telling you. They know a lot about the energy kingdom because they study it from the reverse side of God. And from that side, you don't have to be a genius. You just can follow certain formulas, and they work pretty good. They're not good formulas. They're not truthful formulas in the sense that they reveal God or anything about it. They're devious and destructive to life and to God in their mind, anyway. All right, so the challenge here is for us to gain some understanding of the totality of what the energy kingdom is about. We've got just 10 minutes here to finish this, so let's try and do that. So the energy kingdom is here for the purpose of benefiting all of life. It balances out a system in a way in which it contributes diversity while it allows there to be unity. It is the reason that I say, that as life grows, it gains in individuality while it grows in group consciousness at the same time. It comes more from the energy side than from the spiritual side. Spirit is by definition, unable to sense energy directly. It must use energies that matches its consciousness to be able to have a full sense which is conscious. An unconscious sense is sometimes developed in two forms, or three forms, really. One is called pre-life. The other is called parasitic and/or between kingdom life. Those are things like bacteria and mold. Not all of it's parasitic, but it's between kingdom. Usually between either the mineral and plant or between the plant and animal. Don't have time to go into that, but it's not important right now. And then the third element of this equation is that it is a it deals with the sense from the realm of pure consciousness, in that consciousness is so dependent upon how much information the sense brings in. Why does it do that? Because as the better the sense is, the more it attracts information, energy, which is a form of, all information is some form of energy in it, from bodies of other things, or from forms of other things. It doesn't have to be a body, it forms something. So any kind of form, it attracts a little tiny bit of the fraction of that energy, and that energy then is immediately analyzed and understood by the sense, because the sense is much greater in consciousness than the other energy. It knows what it's about. It's sort of a super analyzing device. And it says, hey, got information for you. There's some water over there. Got some information for you. There's a plant over there. There's an animal over there. There's a person over there. It gives you that information, and then we create knowledge with it through our subconscious part of ourselves by joining together various information so that it makes sense to us. In other words, we can improve our senses. The feedback loop is always that the improvement in sense is what allows us to create knowledge. When we can't improve the sense, when we feel the sense diminishing, we feel confused and we feel as though we have a lack of knowledge. When I say feel, I'm talking about a mental sense of feeling. Most people don't know they have mental senses and that they don't know that they have a kind of feeling sense, but it's true. Okay, so is knowledge... As we can create knowledge better, we know our senses are working okay. And when we can't, we know the senses are not working so good. And people try to improve their senses by practice. and getting the information right so that they can create knowledge that makes their senses even better. Now you could say, well, what about truth? Isn't that the biggest? Well, truth comes from taking the knowledge and becoming more conscious. As you increase your consciousness, it feeds back to teaching the center you do have, even if it's good energy, how to think even better, because consciousness is part of all our major centers. And it increases our sense tremendously to do that, and then you get a big boost. So the knowledge improves the center by making sure the center stays organized and working as it's supposed to. But consciousness improves it way beyond that point by getting it to reach a new level of sense, not just become better organized. A new level of sense comes from getting rid of some of the darker energy and bringing in new, because of the higher consciousness, energy, following thought, greater than itself, new energies that are even more refined and better. You're constantly doing an exchange thing, but you don't know it. And if you're around people who have better senses, the exchange works better because the energy from them also helps, can feed you to some extent. And their consciousness has an effect on you. So the reason to keep the company of people who are more conscious is because you become more conscious by becoming more aware and more knowledgeable and more conscious all at the same time. Wow. So the energy kingdom is a brilliant idea. It's the engine that makes life work. It's used universally throughout the entire universe of the God that we know of. And could other universes work differently? Yes. I'm not in a place to conceive of them. Even this one, just learning how it works is absolutely phenomenal. Trying to create one, give me a blank piece of paper, it's a greater new universe? I don't think so. This universe was obviously created by a being far beyond any human being I know of, and far beyond even some of the beings that are beyond human beings, because it requires such depth of understanding and so much creation. Everything we're talking about was created by the Creator. Everything. The whole system is a massive, unbelievable, enlightened creation. Just amazing stuff. All right. So finally, to sum this up, how do we then, besides just being around people who are more conscious, improve the system within ourselves? Well, practice is one of them, but there's two ways to practice. You can practice so that the body itself becomes better, and so that you get some kind of benefit in terms of a personal value system. Those are called personal ways of practice, or some people call it disciplining their senses. Some people get that from that, and they say, gee, I did a lot of studying. I did a lot of this. It's all the same word as far as I'm concerned. Then the other side of it is, if you do it for others' sake, that's called spiritual discipline. Do it for others' sake. Your improvement is for the benefit of others and not yourself. Now, I keep talking to people who say they're very spiritual, but they're all, almost everything they do to improve in their senses is for themselves. Even if they do something for others, it's, well, but I have the underlying motive here to get this or that. Even if it's just control and power or making yourself look good or something, it's something for yourself. Well, that all defeats the whole idea of spiritual, and it's not spiritual discipline. So the value here is the motive and the direction of where the energy is going to in what we call service, which really is helping others to do more of what you're doing, which is to spiritually help themselves. And to therefore do so by helping other people, not themselves, if you're following what I'm saying. Big, like the pay it forward kind of idea. Yeah, so this is the bottom line of how the system grows. Human beings are incredibly important in it because we are the only beings that aren't higher than ourselves that understand or can understand the process. No other part of the kingdoms understand the process below that of human. And that includes the lunar devas. Only solar devas understand to some extent, and solar angels, and human beings. And that's it. Even the smartest animal could only get an inkling of it by being around a human being and being what we call a pet. So it's an amazing source, amazing thing. And yes, we are running out of time. I hope tonight's show has been enlightening, if not interesting. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.